It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Phase 3 of the coronavirus vaccine trials began Monday in the United States. 30,000 people across the country are expected to take part. There are currently more than 20 different clinical trials happening around the world for various COVID vaccines, all with the hopes of bringing this pandemic to an end. Dr. Paul Dupre is the director of the Center for Vaccine Research at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome, Paul.
Hi there.
Paul, let's get right to the big question. From your experience, how long do you think it will be until we see an effective vaccine?
Yeah, that's the $1 million, $10 million, $100 million question that folks have been asking really from the very beginning of the pandemic. Typically, we say vaccines take years, but of course, we don't have years in this particular situation. So what you will have heard and still hear to this day is between 12 and 18 months is a very fast-tracked and a very rapid way to get to a licensed coronavirus vaccine.
President Trump has called for a vaccine to be distributed in the U.S. by the end of the year. Is that possible?
Well, many things are possible. There's a difference between what is possible and what is likely. When we say 12 to 18 months and you think that the outbreak began and the virus began circulating in the United States January 2020, then by the end of the year, technically, would be at the lower end of that prediction, 12 months. What's challenging for people and what's important to remember is we don't have a coronavirus vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine. We have a lot of candidates, but it's not a vaccine until it's a licensed product. And vaccines are just not one or two doses or tens of doses or even 30,000 doses, as you mentioned in your really nice introduction. The phase 3 trial will have 30,000 participants. Rather, vaccines are millions and millions and tens of millions of doses. So technically, we could vaccinate, and we are vaccinating people with candidate vaccines. But the end of the year is an incredibly ambitious goal. But it's good to be ambitious. But it is also very important to be realistic.
Yeah, so typically, what is the timeline to produce an effective vaccine? I mean, you mentioned 12 to 18 months is really fast paced. But what is the typical time frame?
Oh, anything from 3 to 5 years and sometimes longer than that.
Mm-hmm. How do you balance getting it done quickly with getting it done right?
So right is a good word, but a better word is safe. One of the things which is absolutely vital whenever we are generating new products is that we ensure that everything is tested in the normal rigorous way that we test vaccines. So yes, we can compress the timeline. Typically, vaccines are produced in a rather linear way, 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5, 5 to 6, if you think of the stages. But what we can do to compress those 3 to 5 years into 12 to 18 months is we can run things side by side concurrently. That normally wouldn't be done because it's more cost effective to do it in a linear 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 manner. But if you run things side by side, so you can run 1 and 2, stages 1 and 2 at the same time, move to 3 a little bit faster, start 4 before 5, all of those things can be done to compress the timeline.
Biotech company Moderna and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, part of National Institutes of Health, made the investigational vaccine currently starting phase 3. Give us an idea, what kind of track record do these organizations have when it comes to producing vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, Moderna is a super interesting company. Moderna has never produced a vaccine. In fact, we do not have a licensed messenger RNA vaccine. That's the technology that Moderna use. Of course, the National Institutes of Health, a tremendously important organization funding basic and applied and translational and many, many different sorts of research conducted around the country, has a huge experience in vaccine development. But again, bringing those two bits of that jigsaw puzzle, messenger RNA and the National Institutes of Health together, that has not been done before. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't do it. But to answer your question, they have a lot of experience, but they haven't licensed a vaccine of that type.
So you mentioned messenger RNA, mRNA. For the average person, what is significant about using this if it's never been used before?
So one of the majorly interesting aspects of this approach is they can move really quickly to these clinical trials because the messenger RNA can be produced and can be injected. And they've done that often with other messenger RNAs for different things. And they have been safe and they have led to the generation of immune responses. So what you've done whenever you take messenger RNA, you inject that into the person and the person then makes the proteins from the coronavirus. So whenever you see the images, the little cartoons of coronavirus, you know those sticky out bits on the outside of the sphere? Those are the spike proteins. And the immune system recognizes those spike proteins. It makes antibodies against those spike proteins. And then whenever a person comes in contact with the virus a second time, they will already have antibodies. And the technical term that we use is neutralize. Neutralize just means take out. Those antibodies then can take out the virus at an early stage and it doesn't cause the disease. And actually, that's the basis of vaccination. In many cases, what we do is we trick the immune system into thinking that it has seen the virus, the pathogen. So we create those antibodies without bringing the virus involved. And we allow the immune system to generate antibodies. And then whenever the person meets the virus, it's primed and ready to go. And the immune system is able to tackle that virus because the person has been vaccinated.
Are we going to have to accept a vaccine that is only partially effective to get something out to the public while more research continues?
Yeah, Kevin, that's a really brilliant question. And we already do. Vaccines are not a magic bullet. You look at the flu vaccine year on year, sometimes it works really well. Sometimes it just doesn't work as well. But we know that using vaccines is better than getting the disease. So we already do compromise on vaccines. It's not a black-white situation. It's why we give a prime and then boost vaccines so that whenever we vaccinate those individuals, that they will raise a good immune response. But no vaccine is 100% effective. So we already compromise on that. And that will be the case for the coronavirus vaccine. Maybe Moderna will be the first licensed vaccine, but it is absolutely certain that there will be more than one vaccine for SARS coronavirus 2 to treat COVID-19. And the first might not be the best. And the first might not be the most efficacious, which is why it's really important not to have all of your eggs in one basket and not to only look at vaccine development in one way, in one place, in one particular approach. That's why having lots of different approaches is a very healthy, is a very intelligent, and hopefully will be a very fruitful way to develop these vaccines.
Dr. Paul Dupre is the director of the Center for Vaccine Research at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks for your time and good luck to you and your team.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Great to talk to you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This fall, the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education will study how it could integrate services and academic programs across its 14 state-owned universities. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider spoke with the system's chancellor, Dan Greenstein, about his pitch for a system-wide redesign that he says would give students more options.
So this is about growth and opportunity. This is not about cost-cutting and, you know, financial decline. Higher education is more important today than probably at any time in the past, right? Our estimates, and this is true nationally, but in Pennsylvania, we estimate that 60% of the workforce today requires some form of post-secondary education. Currently, we're at 47%. We have to educate more people, not fewer, in order to keep the lights on in the economy. I mean, that's just a basic thing one. Thing two, our students today are fundamentally different than they were 25, 30 years ago. Our employers need a fundamentally different range of educational opportunities and experiences than we were putting on 25 and 30 years ago. And so you know, the integrations that we're talking about are part of a long-running process to continue to adapt, changing everything, being willing to change everything we do so we can continue to serve our historic mission, which is to provide that pathway into the middle class and beyond, that pathway into mobility, that to act as an engine of economic development and social mobility in the Commonwealth.
The different form of education you're talking about, of what employers need from future employees, can that not happen at one university? Do you need this kind of system-wide adjustment to do that?
Well, so think about it. So here I am, I'm a university of, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000. I'm a university of 10,000. I can offer the breadth of programs that my enrollment-driven revenues and state funding allows me to support. So, you know, I'm making choices. I'm gonna do nursing, but I'm not gonna do physician assistants. But the community of employers that I'm serving, they still need all the things I'm not doing. The students who wanna go to that university may want access to all those things. So, right, so scale matters. No, it is not possible even for Harvard to offer the full range of post-secondary education that is required. And Harvard's got like a $38 billion endowment.
And then this time last year, you know, the system froze tuition, and you had said, you know, that's sending a message to Harrisburg, and now we're in a pandemic. So can you talk about how the pandemic has it exacerbated the issues that the state system was already facing in terms of enrollment decline, financial loss?
So enrollment is too early to tell. Who knows, right? We'll know how many students when they show up. You know, there are a number of things operating in our favor with respect to enrollment and tuition. I think there's a general, I think our price is helping. I think there's a real reticence about, you know, returning. If people are, you know, going to a high price institution, maybe thinking, you know, maybe roll back a little bit, especially given the fact the experience is going to be different. I think in terms of financially, it really, some of that depends on what happens in the fall. We're certainly not going to be in any better shape. But, you know, I think this is an exciting time. I do. I mean, it's a time that's filled with, you know, all sorts of uncertainty, not just about education. It just in general. I mean, the world is we're at a watershed moment in so many different ways. And, you know, the opportunities that opens up, we need real leaders going forward, you know, and so the economy is, you know, needs just injection of talent. So that creates opportunities for students. It creates opportunities for education to prepare those we have the privilege of working with them. So I'm actually a repressible optimist. I think higher education will come out of this stronger, more resilient, even more responsive and effective than it was going in. And we were pretty good in all those categories.
That was Dan Greenstein, the chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, speaking with WESA's Sarah Schneider. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh is challenging to navigate. It developed from a hodgepodge of former boroughs and municipalities, and its hills and river valleys prevented planners from creating a traditional street grid. On top of that, local drivers have some idiosyncratic behaviors. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports on the murky history of the Pittsburgh Left.
A lot of good question askers want to know about the Pittsburgh Left.
As an immigrant to Pittsburgh from central Ohio, where it's flat and roads are perpendicular to each other, it took some time to adapt to Pittsburgh driving.
If someone was going to make a left turn at the change of a stoplight, then you would let them go first so as to not hold up all the traffic behind it, and then you would proceed.
The Pittsburgh left-hand turn makes me feel part of the community, like neighbors are helping each other out.
That was Bob Pachua, Seth Finn, and Jackie Sloganoff. The so-called Pittsburgh left they're describing is typically indicated by a wave from the driver going straight or a quick flash of the headlights. It's unclear exactly when the practice began. The earliest mention in available newspaper archives is 1985. But Alexander Stefanovich, a civil and environmental engineering professor at the University of Pittsburgh, says it probably began much earlier. As cars became more ubiquitous throughout the 20th century, dense city streets weren't prepared for the increase in traffic.
And when you don't have enough capacity, that's where people are going to have to find their own ways to maximally utilize what they have.
But Stefanovich says the Pittsburgh left persisted as a way for drivers to pay it forward.
You let somebody to make that left turn right now because you know that later you're going to benefit from it. And people just learn over time and they adapt.
I always explain the situation of, you know, it's courtesy that people are letting you go, but you have to be careful.
Tim Rogers with Rogers Driving School has been teaching students about the behavior for years.
There could be a car coming and you can encounter that car and have an accident.
After all, taking a Pittsburgh left is technically illegal. Pennsylvania law dictates left-turning drivers must yield to oncoming traffic. Jeff Schneider is a research professor at Carnegie Mellon University and helped found Uber's self-driving car division. He says the by-the-book approach is typically how self-driving vehicles are trained when they hit the roads.
We wouldn't ever program our cars to do something that, you know, wasn't legally the right thing to do.
These vehicles are constantly collecting data about other drivers' behavior, which is where Schneider says machine learning comes into play.
Essentially, when we collect all the data from other cars driving around in the streets, eventually the learning algorithms will see that pattern.
The city isn't as populated and congested as it used to be, so need for the Pittsburgh left is diminished. Alexander Stefanovich says, even so, it's a part of the region.
Pittsburgh left maybe is a part of the cultural heritage that this whole area has.
Stefanovich says the Pittsburgh left isn't just about transportation, but about the region's cultural heritage. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, Doug Schugertz, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.